From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, how our state became a battleground for the development of large-scale data centers.
Now you have some of the most well-capitalized companies in the world taking advantage of a tax exemption here in the state for data centers, coming in with open wallets.
Then researchers from MSU team up with Native Nations to find out what trees can tell us about historic land management techniques.
The goal of the project is to work collaboratively to learn from the stories that trees and indigenous communities tell about fire so that we can bring good fire back to these places.
And how changes from the Trump administration could affect tribal input on historic preservation.
It's going to severely hinder how that community can protect those burial sites.
Stay with us. Those stories coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, we are going to be talking about how Native American tribes in Michigan have laid groundwork for new kinds of preservation work in our state.
Something that might seem as simple as understanding a fire-scarred landscape. It helps me with historic preservation by showing me where our historic sites are and a better understanding of how deep that history goes, what kind of impact we've had on that landscape.
But first, data center proposals continue to explode in Michigan. A new series of two stories by Cranes Detroit explores Michigan's status as a major battleground for the processing power of more than 25 large-scale projects proposed over the last 2 years. Some of the industry's largest companies, including Google, Microsoft, Anthropic, and Meta, are behind many of these. And the article shed some light on where these projects are taking root and where they're having more struggles. Can we just review what data center capacity is most needed for in the industry?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's the front-facing stuff that you and I see, you know, when we go into a ChatGPT or Claude, or things like that, where you're asking it questions, it's doing simple sort of things. But really, obviously, the need is at the commercial level. Companies integrating these AI systems into their independent systems to perform labor. I mean, that's the bulk of it, right? To run complicated scenarios, to create pitch decks for sales proposals or whatever it may be, these things that require a lot of computing power to do it so quickly that would take days, weeks, months, whatever for traditional humans to do. That's the bulk of the business. And, you know, I think Anthropic said its, you know, potential net worth is like $30 trillion, right? Or some insane thing like that, because these companies are in so much demand at the commercial industrial level.
You opened one of your recent articles about this with an observation that was an eye-opener for me, pointing out that the reason why Michigan is a desirable location for some of these projects maybe has less to do with available land, maybe a bit less to do with state policies toward development, but something about our capacity for power. Can you explain?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think the first, you know, particularly when you're talking to people that don't want to see data centers, which is a very large number of people, you know, the first thing is because we're the Great Lakes state, it must be the water. But that's really far from the truth, because if you look at where they're going, Texas, Virginia, you know, places that certainly have less water than us, and they have far more data centers than us. It's really about electricity demand and where there is available electricity. Michigan, over the course of the last, you know, 50 years or so, I think it peaked in the 70s, actually, our industrial electrical demand, when manufacturing was at its peak. Obviously, we've become more efficient at manufacturing, which reduces electrical use at the commercial industrial level. And also, we just have fewer manufacturing. Manufacturing in this state has not grown in a significant amount of years. The amount of products we can produce has grown. The output has grown, but not the actual size and scope and the way that they do things. And so really, we have this sort of stagnant electrical infrastructure that isn't being used. You know, the supply, we have at least 5 gigawatts now and can ramp up to much higher. And also that's sort of coupled with this idea that we have failing infrastructure that need desperate improvements. And now you have some of the most well-capitalized companies in the world taking advantage of a tax and exemption here in the state for data centers, coming in with open wallets.
So this was really a new way for me to think about this, because I tend to look at consumer electric rates in Michigan, which are going up, and I don't tend to think of us as a place with a lot of extra capacity. Can you explain, you know, sort of the difference between retail prices, I guess, that consumers pay, and market capacity as DTE and consumers and other companies deal in it?
Sure. So you have to sort of look at it as a supply issue, right? Like, we have tons of, say it's gasoline, say it's whatever, you know, we have tons of supply, but the issue is the restriction in getting it there, right? People make more money that work the power lines. We're seeing power lines fail more often. So that requires more people to work on them. The modern infrastructure that is being updated is much more expensive, just as your groceries have gone up. So has the parts that would go into, you know, these stations that transfer the power. So everything goes up in price. So you're never going to see prices of electricity really go down. You might see them slow down, but really that's why prices have been rising. And they've also had to rise because, you know, the utilities in the state spent, you know, the better part of 30 years not reinvesting as much into their infrastructure. And electrical demand is going up, but just not on the industrial level. It's going up. And, you know, how many devices do you now run in your home that have plugs? It's going up and up and up at the residential level, and those require infrastructure improvements,
right?
Which costs money.
So let's get to the mapping, which is a really interesting piece of this story. Can you talk about how many data centers are actually up and running in Michigan right now, and how we stack up against other states?
Sure. So it depends what you're looking at. If you're looking at hyperscale, these large ones that you're seeing, like in Sling Township, the controversial one there, we have zero, a whopping zero. If you do look at data centers as they existed before these large ones came into existence, you know, 5-10 years ago, in some capacity, they're smaller. You know, they're much smaller than a department store, things like that. They're you know, 100,000 feet, maybe a small grocery store size. I believe we have about 50 to 75 of those, probably closer to the 50 range than 75. But they exist sort of all over the state, and those are more co-location. So that might be where you would put these servers to store, say Ford wants to store their servers. They don't want to do it in-house. They can rent space and put their servers into these locations. Those exist quite a few all over the state. These new, you know, hyperscale and these data center rush that's currently happening is really more about artificial intelligence and the ability to compute massive amounts of data and spit out some sort of, you know, product or algorithm or whatever it is at the end. Those are really what we're seeing now, and we have zero of those.
Going down the list of data centers that you investigated, from the barn in Saline Township to Project Cannoli in Van Buren Township, I was interested to see that there are a lot of permitting issues that seem to be in the wind here. Now, I don't know, and I don't want to project, but it seems like the state generally is not in the business of not granting permits unless there is a major outstanding issue that needs to be resolved. Is that your observation of how this generally tends to work as well?
Yeah, I mean, what we're really seeing is very little to do with the permitting process. I mean, it's really the local approvals that are going through. So these giant companies are coming into these small townships and you know, these local municipalities. I mean, a lot of these people aren't even full-time. And so they're overwhelmed. And the state really hasn't provided any guidance on this, on how to handle this. So these communities are being overrun with citizens that don't want these, that are saying, no, vote these down. But there's very little the communities can actually do in a lot of cases. As long as these projects meet, you know, the property that they're looking at meets the correct zoning and they meet all of the proper criteria that's been set forth, there's not really a lot these communities can do. So we've seen a lot of these communities institute these moratoriums, like, okay, 6 months or a year, we can't move forward with any sort of data center development, which historically courts and things have sort of sided with communities on these. But we have two lawsuits currently against these moratoriums that are playing out. And that, I think, is really going to define whether a lot of these projects move forward or whether they don't. Because if the court decides that they can't, you know, keep these moratoriums, that this actually violates Michigan state law and zoning, you're going to see a lot of these lawsuits crop up and you're going to see a lot of these moratoriums go away. And then these developments are going to happen really rapidly. But if the courts say, no, these moratoriums are in fact, you know, lawful and fine, some of these people might just run out of room, right? Some of these projects might say, you know what, we this is a race. We want to get our AI data infrastructure up immediately. We're going to bow out and withdraw our application and move on to somewhere else.
Dustin, there's something that I've wondered as I've seen proposal after proposal come up in either somewhat green areas of Michigan or also in farmland. Why is it that data center projects frequently are built on land that has been uninhabited? All of us can think of empty shopping malls or factory spaces near us that could use some redevelopment. Do you have any sense of why those have been less desirable for these?
Yeah, that's been a big question that everyone brings up. Everyone's like, well, I don't get it. Why don't they go to, you know, Flint or Detroit or this? And they have in other states. The reality is here in Michigan is so many of those places are, you know, these brownfields that are dilapidated factories. I mean, the issue is that you have to look at what these AI developers are trying to do. They're trying to bring scale and they're in a race to see who gets there first. In their mind, if we can stand up a giant AI data center and build our large language model AI systems, we are going to win this race. It's a race just like, you know, the space race, right? The first one to the moon wins. And so if you choose a brownfield, it takes time to destroy a factory that's, you know, a dilapidated building that's standing there. If you, you know, touch the concrete paddock that is below that building, that now triggers EPA testing to see what contaminations that former factory left in the ground. Those processes just take a lot longer. And the other issue is we don't have a lot. Sure, we have these big factories, but maybe it's not like enough contiguous land. Maybe there's not enough electrical flow to those factories, and that would be more difficult for one of our utilities to get the proper gigawattage to those facilities, or more expensive. So these undeveloped farmlands that are available probably at a cheap rate, because as you know, farming has also been declining for generations across the state. Likely this cheap land is available and they can piece together 1,000 acres, 500 acres with an owner or two, and then move through the permitting process quickly and get these things constructed on fresh ground without involving all of the sort of regulatory framework that goes around, you know, trying to develop a existing industrial area.
Dustin Walsh is a senior reporter at Cranes Detroit, and you can find a couple of very informative recent stories that he filed on Michigan's data centers at cranesdetroit.com. Dustin, good talking to you. Thanks for this work.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. After that, a project up north giving clarity to our history of land management by Native tribes.
I'm from California. If you don't have fire stewardship, prescribed fire, you're going to have catastrophic wildfires. And we can have those here in the Great Lakes as well.
That's after the break. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Earlier this summer, Michigan was smothered with smoke from wildfires in Ontario and Minnesota. Those fires reignited debates about forest management on both sides of the U.S.-Canadian border. With the smoke cleared for now, it's a pretty good time to re-examine our relationship with fire. Michigan's forests are no strangers to fire, and neither are the people who've called these forests home since time immemorial. As Patrick Shea reports, a collaborative research project is setting the stage to reintroduce cultural fire near the Straits of Mackinac. Let's listen.
In the far north of the Mitten, let's say near the tip of the ring finger, these researchers are looking for stories in old tree stumps. With the stump sliced off at the top, we can see annual tree rings. Each ring represents 1 year of growth for a red pine that once stood here. And every 6 to 10 rings, there's a dark indentation, a healed over fire scar. These are visible signs of prescribed fires, started by the ancestors of people who still call this place home.
Like, this is definitely so much more than just research. This really is an act of healing.
That's May Wright, Tribal Historic Preservation Officer with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians.
Indigenous. So I'm saying I'm a citizen of Wauganakasing, Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to my family, my extended relatives, I'm Bear Clan. And in my community, My name is Nijia Wei, but I'm just May in English.
May is part of this diverse and eclectic research team, working to construct a fire history here in the heart of Odawa homelands.
It stretches from the north shore of the streets, historically covered in Odawa villages, and it goes all the way down to about Charlevoix area. But then there's also Odawa connection to places even farther in Grand Traverse area, all the way down to the Grand River where we would be wintering. It goes east over to Manitoulin, where we've got relatives still, and it goes west over to the Beaver Island Archipelago into Door County over in Wisconsin. It's a massive territory, so really where we are right now, when you look at a map of it, we're in the centerpiece of it all.
Yeah.
Some of the samples they've taken date all the way back to the 1650s. And as a tribal historian, when May looks at these tree rings and fire scars, she thinks about what was going on in this place, around these old trees.
So when I'm seeing these dates, what I'm seeing is, that's right, that's when the first mission came through here. This is when the fort was burned down. This is when we were moving because there were smallpox epidemics coming through the community and so many people were getting sick. This is when we had people being shifted down to Detroit during the Fox Wars and there was so much chaos.
And even with all that turmoil, upheaval, and adversity through the years, May's ancestors were still using fire, or ishkode, as a tool on the landscape.
What I'm seeing is, all throughout that time period, this beautiful, consistent presence during all of these other huge shifts in religion and economics and politics and war and sickness, during all of this that's happening to our community that we're reacting to and that we're navigating through, we're still maintaining that connection with Shkode in all these different ways. And that's so special. Because then it just helps to reaffirm that this is our home.
Using tree ring records, or dendrochronology, these researchers are piecing together a story that ties people to place. This collaborative research project is called Setting the Straits on Fire. And that's the goal, to reintroduce cultural fire in the region.
This is an extremely resilient ecosystem. And this is, at the same time, showing the resilience of these people that are going through all this trauma, but are still burning this place, are still tending to the land.
That's Josh Cohen, the lead ecologist on this project. He's the senior conservation scientist with the Michigan Natural Features Inventory, an arm of Michigan State University Extension. The project is a cooperative agreement with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's Coastal Program, and the focal area is the Straits of Mackinac.
The goal of the project is to work collaboratively to learn from the stories that trees and indigenous communities tell about fire so that we can bring good fire back to these places to create more resilient ecological communities, more resilient communities in terms of places where people can return to expressing their cultural rights, and also places that are more resilient to climate change.
Climate change is causing drier, hotter summers in the Great Lakes. And in doing so, it's extending the fire season and increasing the risk of fires burning out of control.
Like, I'm from California. If you don't have fire stewardship, prescribed fire, you're going to have catastrophic wildfires. And we can have those here in the Great Lakes as well. This is a climate adaptation strategy to create more resilient landscapes, getting fire back to prevent the next big wildfire.
But preventing catastrophic wildfires isn't the only reason to bring back what Josh calls good fire. There are lots of reasons why the Anishinaabe burned here in northern Michigan.
So that could be like long-range visibility, being able to see at far distances, impacting forage for different grazers, managing these mobility corridors from moving from like sugar bush to ricin camps. And so there's a lot of different uses of fire.
Mary Parr is a fire ecologist with the Michigan Natural Features Inventory.
Buju, Mishkwa Benishikwe, Indigenakaz, Wabsheshi Ndodem, Bawateng Ndojabar, Anishinaabe Ndau, Ojibwa Ndau. I'm Pine Marten Clan, and I'm a member of the Sault Ste. Marie tribe of Chippewa Indians.
Mary says the right kind of fire can refresh and revitalize an ecosystem.
Fire is like nothing else in the world. It is something that can breathe, can move across the landscape, can transform things and rejuvenate things. And so there's just something about that natural disturbance and that spirit that is mesmerizing.
Mary says that rejuvenating nature of fire is reflected in the word for fire in the Anishinaabe language.
The one we use a lot is Ishkode or Shkode, depending on the dialect. And the Ish means like new, and then Ode is heart, like new heart. So like new flourishing, revitalizing.
New flourishing is especially needed here, a place the local Odawa call the Blueberry Plains.
You can see walking through the woods, there's a lot of blueberries that are coming up, but they're not necessarily fruiting.
Right. Derek Hartline is a conservation biologist for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. This forest floor is covered in blueberry plants, but there's too much shade and competition for them to produce fruit. Derek says fire can change that.
So say you burn a stand, your first year after burning, your blueberries are going to have this much production in blueberries. The second year, you're going to have even better production. Third year is going to be your peak year. And then on year 4 and 5, production is going down. It's time to burn again.
In preparation for this research project, Derek and his colleagues held listening sessions with tribal elders who shared their memories of prescribed fire here in the Blueberry Plains.
We had a really good turnout. About 50 community members came, and we kind of just met. I had dinner together and then had a ceremony, a water ceremony, to kind of open the night out with good intentions. And then once we finished up our ceremony, we got around in a circle and just kind of had a very nonchalant, informal conversation about fire and what different elders remembered of burning certain areas or what their grandmas told them.
The dominant narrative among most ecologists had been that these types of forests, pine-dominated, dry mesic northern forests, didn't have much fire in them. Just infrequent, major stand-replacing fires, hundreds of years apart. But stories from the region's original inhabitants and tree ring records from across the region are challenging that narrative.
It was used a lot more frequent than we thought. I mean, they were using it for all sorts of things. The tool fire was so important to Odawa. I mean, it was a part of their lifestyles. They didn't think twice about lighting fire.
Prescribed fire is becoming more widely adopted as a tool for state and federal land managers. But the problem is, the models they use to determine where and when to burn in northern Michigan aren't accounting for the more frequent, less intense fires started intentionally by the Odawa and Ojibwe throughout the Straits region. The goal of this project is to update those models used by state and federal agencies and to make sure that cultural fires, like the ones here in the Blueberry Plains, are included in the data.
It's about building momentum to be able to demonstrate that we can burn these places safely and they have a real benefit, but then at the same time maintaining that going forward. It's not about one burn, right?
Kurt Kipfmuller is the lead dendrochronologist overseeing the collection of this cultural and ecological data.
I study tree rings to help reconstruct past environments. I've done a lot of work across the country with both fire and climate change. And then I've been doing fire histories across the Great Lakes since 2004.
Kurt recently moved back to his home state of Michigan, where he's a professor of tribal and indigenous natural resource management in Michigan State University's Department of Forestry. He says his research in the Great Lakes specifically has changed the way he thinks about dendrochronology.
Often you would approach something like this as from an ecological problem or an ecological standpoint, but it's so much more about the cultural side of it that I think is so important. Like, and I think that that's something for me is a terms of career trajectory that it took me a while to like not remove people from the story, because I worked so hard to remove people from the story because I wanted to understand the ecological side, thinking about people as being unnatural, right, not part of nature.
Right.
And I think a lot differently about that now. When you guys are out here, and like I learned so much.
Knowledge about fire or Ishkode as a land tending tool has persisted in tribal communities. It's been passed down through stories as traditional ecological knowledge. But Kurt says dendrochronology helps people see, feel, and even smell that historical connection.
Give it a good smell. I know you can't capture smell on radio, but
it smells amazing.
Any day now,
incredible.
They'll figure it out.
It's so good.
One of the best smells.
This round slice of stump, called a cookie, is so aromatic. As Kurt lifts the cookie off the stump, the air fills with a strong, piney scent. That smell is red pine resin, and it's the reason this stump is still here and why its tree rings are still visible. Derek Hartline explains as he finds another good stump for sampling.
So this guy in particular, why he's a good one, is we got to do a kick test. So it's solid. So when we cut it, we got to make sure we get a good sample off it. And then each one of these healed over lesions, like you saw on the cookie, is a different fire event, so a scar.
Red pines secrete resin to heal those scars, which causes the wood to harden and solidify, preventing decay. That's why this stump is still here, hundreds of years later.
And so, like, this is still solid. This is what's filled with resin. If you think of it like a human, when you hurt yourself, you're going to scab over, you're scarring. And so, like, the rest of the tree rotted off.
So the use of cultural fire not only made these woods a great place for gathering blueberries in the past, but it also preserved the history that this research team is gathering now.
Doing stuff like this, I think, helps people to see, like, there's maybe, this is, let's just guess, okay? This is probably, this is 200 years. There's 10 fires in there. That's a lot of fire on this landscape. Emily, how often has this burned since you've lived up here?
Not once.
Emily Proctor is another partner on this project and serves on the tribal council for the Little Traverse Bay Bands.
Ani, Odemakwe Indigenous Kas, Migizi Ndodam, Waganaksing Odawa, Cross Village, Lansing, and Donjiba, Harbor Springs, Enda. Strawberry Woman, Eagle Clan, Place of the Crooked Tree. Folks knew a thing or two about life in this part of the world, as they did in many others. Even with the time I spent with my awesome team here, like, I've learned, but pieced together what I somewhat instinctually knew and experienced in life. Does that make sense? So that's helped me, but also hopefully helped our staff and
us
to educate folks in a slow and steady manner. So when you are going to burn, it's not going to be like, we're all burning, what's going on in our neighborhood?
The kind of reaction Emily's describing is not uncommon. There's a lot of fear associated with forest fires in wider society. And understandably so. Just think of all that smoke folks inhaled earlier this summer across Michigan. But this isn't the first time that fear of fire has taken hold in the state. Major wildfires in the late 1800s led to an outright ban on starting fires on public land. Doing so would mean you could face hefty fines, and maybe even be thrown in jail. That put a damper on the use of cultural fire, but it didn't stamp it out entirely.
I mean, there's a reason I learned about just a little bit of fire, right? Because family knew. And you learn about bears, you learn about Anishinaabe Mohan, because some of that had to go underground to make sure it continues on. And that was a risk. That was a calculated risk. And I want to say that we as Anishinaabe people are very calculated and strategic in everything that we've done. And there's a reason why we've continued to thrive and continue to build, because we had the foresight to strategize. So darn right they had fear. Folks still hunted. Folks still fished. Darn right they did.
Folks still burned.
Kurt Kipfmuller again.
So we know, like, there's stories across the Great Lakes of people burning, like, okay, I'm just going to burn this and then I'm going to just go away.
Right.
And I know that that happened in the Boundary Waters. We heard that in the Upper Peninsula at another listening session. We've heard it in a lot of different listening sessions where people are like, yeah, we knew we weren't supposed to burn, but, you know, we just burned.
Although it was done in secret, a case could be made for cultural fire as a part of Anishinaabe treaty rights on ceded territories. Fire was a key component of a way of life that was meant to be preserved in the 1836 Treaty of Washington, which ceded territory to the federal government but guaranteed sovereign rights like hunting, fishing, gathering, and other, quote, usual privileges of occupancy. Mary Parr compares the use of fire to tribal fishing rights, which finally received state and federal recognition after legal battles fought throughout the 1970s and 80s.
They have set precedents as far as fishing rights that have gone through to Supreme Court, a lot of cases that affirm those treaty rights. But fire hasn't had that yet.
Not yet.
So if we were to burn in this state park using cultural ways, it would be considered arson, and like we'd be liable to get arrested. We kind of have to utilize the current channels that exist, which are very slow.
Today, the Odawa's Blueberry Plains are part of Wilderness State Park. But the slow process of bringing good fire back here is underway. The Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians is collaborating with the Department of Natural Resources to draft a new stewardship plan for Wilderness State Park, which will include a burn plan for culturally significant sites like the Blueberry Plains. May Wright says those burns would bring back more than just blueberries.
What we're doing out here, it's so deeply rooted in those practices of decolonization.
But the way that we're doing it is based in community and connection and collaboration, right? It's based in so many good things. And in that hopeful mindset, and that hope is that those future generations, for them, it won't be a struggle to connect to this history. It won't be a struggle to connect to Škoda. It's going to be something that's just so natural. They're able to expect it.
That stewardship plan is on track to be open for public comment this fall. So a future where the Odawa are once again starting cultural fires in the Blueberry Plains is in sight. And that's a sign of their resilience, which Josh Cohen says is really what this project is all about.
This is a story of resilient people, of a resilient tree, of a resilient ecosystem. And there is that hope to learn from those stories about what do we do now? Mm-hmm. So the title of the project is Setting the Straits on Fire. And we use that as a way to say, what are you going to do? Mm-hmm. What are you going to do about it, about what we're learning?
Josh says he hopes that by opening these stumps, this research will open people's minds to a healthier relationship with Škoda, one that honors the knowledge and culture of the region's original inhabitants and reignites the use of good fire in the Great Lakes State. For Stateside, I'm Patrick Shea.
We need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll speak with one of the tribal leaders working on the Tree Rings project with Michigan State. Stay with us. This is Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We've been listening to a visit that Patrick Shea took with a field of researchers seeking data about biosystems, data that they find through the records of trees, dendrochronology. And as you've heard, it's a remarkably clear and informative record of land management, as practiced by many Anishinaabe tribal nations throughout history. And dendrochronology is also helping us answer some very modern questions, too. My next guest is here to tell us about that. May Wright, with the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians, has some professional responsibilities to culture, history, and tribal survivance. May Anin, it's so good to have you. Would you like to introduce yourself to everyone?
Yes, thank you. Menogi Jakakina. Now, what that is just a classic Nishnab introduction. We all do it a little differently. And what I'm doing is not showing off. I'm not trying to be pageantry or anything about, oh, look at me, I practice my language so well. What I'm attempting to do is follow cultural protocol and have those layers of transparency when I introduce myself. So I begin with, I'm a citizen of the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. I'm an Odawa woman from that community. I grew up in the northern parts of the state. I say Michigan Giwe, the Nong and the Onjaba, the northern parts. We don't really have a word for the UP. So that's about as close as I can get to saying that my family's from St. Ignace and up outside Marquette. I'm a little all over. Yeah. And now living with Kwadonsing in Harbor Springs. And that's where I work for my community. I love living here. I'm very spoiled. My home is beautiful. And I'm Bear Clan. I'm Makondodam, which for Anishinaabe communities gives an idea of my extended relatives, the responsibilities I have in ceremony. There's a lot tied just to your dodam. And in my community, my name is Nijowe. But in English, all of that gets turned into, hi, I'm May. It's nice to meet you.
Well, thank you for all of it. Language matters, and it shapes us, and it shapes our world, too. We appreciate it. So as the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer for the Little Traverse Bay Bands, it sounds like in your job that treaties and laws have laid the groundwork for some of the priorities in your work. Can you tell us about it a little bit?
Absolutely. Yes, as a Tribal Historic Preservation Officer, I work within federal and state legislation that's all connected through this idea of cultural resources. And when it comes to that scope of work, a heavy focus for my daily work, my daily life, when I'm looking at cultural resources and where my responsibilities are, it lies within the 1836 treaty territory. And when it comes to how Michigan was formed, the 1836 Treaty of Washington was the largest land cession that allowed Michigan to become a state in 1837. It was about 13.8 million acres. that were seeded. It was massive. But it's so important for folks to remember that the land might have been seeded, but our rights to maintain a connection with that land and with the waterways within that boundary, that was not ceded. That was retained. It was not given to us by signing that document. Those rights were retained. So I do my best to understand the impact that my community has had on the landscape within that territory and also outside the bounds of it too, because we weren't always just within this one 1836 boundary.
Sure. There are some different treaty rights and treaty responsibilities and practices that have come out of this work. Can you tell us when there is some kind of project, whether it's construction on, you know, some kind of commercial building that might be part of reservation land, or maybe work on a state park project that might dovetail with land that is held by the tribe. Can you tell us a little bit about what your role is in those situations?
Now, as someone who works for a tribal historic preservation office, that means that my community was able to sign an MOA with the National Park Service through the Department of Interior to establish an official depot office, just like we have the State Historic Preservation Office. So what that means then is anytime there is ground disturbing work within our home territories or lands that we are connected to, whether that's through reservation boundaries or through historic connections and Aboriginal and ceded land, if that project is receiving federal assistance or a federal permit or federal permission, and if the word federal gets brought up at any point, then that project becomes considered an undertaking. And it's subject to review through laws like the National Historic Preservation Act, which I do a lot of my work through under Section 106 specifically of that legislation. So it means then that when a project is happening, let's say it can cover any end of a spectrum. It could be, you know, a massive international pipeline coming through our territory. It could be just an apartment complex down the street that's getting some HUD funding to repave their parking lot, right? It covers a huge spectrum. So when that project is going through its review process and all the planning periods and public comment, all sorts of things, within all of that framework, there's conversations with people like me and offices like mine, where I'm meant to help and consult and help the applicants for that project better understand how that project could impact historic properties or sacred spaces, traditional cultural landscapes. And how, if there is an impact, how we can avoid it, minimize it, mitigate, all sorts of ways that you're able to negotiate and talk back and forth.
So before the break, we were listening to some of the work that's being done to inform our understanding of land management in the tribal sense and controlled burns, among other things. How does that enhance timeline that the research gives us? Are there ways that that informs the work that you do?
Oh my goodness, it really does. I get so excited every time I'm out in the field and we have a new area that we're able to delineate has the consistent fire scarred trees that now these beautiful red pine are these record keepers for us. And when it comes to how I then am able to use that information and relate to that information, that happens in multiple ways within my responsibilities for my tribe. Because of the way the statute is written for my office, it means that whoever is working in our historic preservation office is not only doing Section 106 work and consulting with state and federal agencies in that way, but they are also meant to be our NAGPRA representative. So NAGPRA stands for Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act that was passed back in 1990. And it's a way for me to be able to communicate with institutions that now have my relatives and burial items and sacred items in their collections, how I can get those people home, how I can make sure collections are being cared for. There's a lot that goes into it. So something that might seem as simple as understanding a fire-scarred landscape, it helps me with historic preservation in Section 106 by showing me where our historic sites are and a better understanding of how deep that history goes, what kind of impact we've had on that landscape. What does that impact actually look like? How have these trees been culturally modified? Where are they? How to identify them? And how I then can protect those areas from ground disturbing work or from timber sales and things like that. Because really, when the team is out there and we're collecting samples from these fire scarred stumps, what you're doing is above ground archaeology. What you're doing is collecting cultural artifacts, this evidence of human impact on a landscape. It's so profound. And also, it's just beautiful work to do. So understanding cultural impact on a landscape, that's one way that all of this information helps me, and it helps me to go into consultations and better understand how I can protect those places, where they are, how to talk about them. But then it also helps in NAGPRA work, which I know at first might seem strange, or it might seem odd about how you make that connection. But let's say, for example, we have a relative who was stolen from their gravesite somewhere in northern Emmett County and then sold to a museum. And that museum was able to keep at least some minimal record showing that this is a native person. This is where they were taken from, the rough boundary. This is when it happened. Then when I find them, when I'm going through museum inventories, I'm able to put in a claim for that person and go through consultation with that institution to better show them how that is my relative and here's how I know. And one way I'm able to show that is by showing my community's territory, where we live, where we have lived, how long we've been there. In any way that I can further substantiate all of those oral histories and previously written documents with something like fire scarred history that helps to show, yes, consistently, we've been in this landscape and marking this landscape. All of that helps me in both scenarios, whether I'm talking to the feds or whether I'm talking to a museum.
Yeah. I don't want to get us too far afield from your work, but I am aware that right now the Trump administration has proposed some changes to historic preservation laws. And this is something that has come up just within the last couple of months, and it seems like it would have a lot of intersection with your work. As I understand these changes, they would affect several different kinds of review, redefining the kinds of properties that even get an examination when there's some kind of build going on. But I think if I'm reading this right, it would also get rid of requirements to consult with tribes. If this does happen, it's an administrative change. It doesn't involve an act of Congress. Can you say a little bit about how big a change that would be to the process as it now stands?
If this rewrite goes through, I'm sorry, it really does make me catch my breath a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It does, because it would be profound. When it comes to a federal government's trust responsibilities for tribal nations and Congress's responsibilities for that government-to-government communication, a rewrite like this would strip authority in so many different and important scenarios when it comes to tribal historic preservation offices, state historic preservation offices, local governments, community voices. If this rewrite would go through, there are so many ways now where a voice of somebody like me and the work that I do, working as a TIPO, it simply wouldn't matter anymore. It would be a box that gets checked without me even being in the room half the time. Being able to see if this proposed rewrite, it brings in this new language that narrows the scope of what we decide is a historic property, and a historic property that a tribe has a voice when it comes to how that property is being outlined and how it's being cared for. It minimizes those connections, because as we talked about, when it comes to the scope of where my tribe's focus is and my work is, cultural resources and historic landscapes that I'm meant to protect, it's not just within a reservation boundary. We can thank 1830s Removal Act for that. There's tribes all over what we now consider the U.S. who have historic village sites and burial grounds that are nowhere near their modern day reservations. And if a rewrite like this were to go through, it's going to severely hinder how that community can protect those burial sites and protect those sacred areas. And it's going to limit something like the definition for a traditional cultural landscape and how that's actually being defined and whether or not that actually matters when it comes to these consultations about federal projects.
Can you tell us anything about Native Nations' efforts to oppose it? I mean, is there some response to this, whether legal or just trying to get the administration or Congress on board with, you know, what a substantial change it really would be?
As one Thibo working for one sovereign nation, I definitely can't speak for other nations. But I can at least give voice to or comment on the fact that within the historic preservation field, whether I'm talking with other Thibos or talking with state historic officials, everybody is concerned that I've talked to, and there is movement. There's movement in the form of open letters and call outs to Congress asking, please reconsider, do not allow this to go through. There's organizations on the national level that are trying to help rally with some of our communities here and trying to find those legal avenues. So there definitely is a lot of activity happening. I have hope. I'm nervous, but I do have hope.
There are a number of things going on in the policy world. I mean, is this the sort of thing that people who just hear about it and are concerned can maybe have an impact or get their voice heard?
Absolutely. You absolutely do. Everybody's voice matters in this fight. So please, if this work is important to you and preserving your local history is important to you and historic sites, please do. You can reach out to your members of Congress who represent your areas. You can write to the governor's office. You can visit these different resources. And eventually, there will come a point where once the Advisory Council on Historic Preservation has reviewed this rewrite further, and it goes through a couple more steps, eventually there will become a public comment period. And that's also going to be a chance for you to have your voice heard.
Is there anything that you would say about what this adds to the community and the tribe's, you know, sense of its own history and itself through the kind of both having that relationship that you have with other communities that are interacting with tribal land, and just for people's understanding about their own history and their own story?
I think some of my favorite days when we've been out in the field have been when we have partners and guests come with us to experience a day out in the bush, gathering these samples and sitting next to these culturally modified red pines and looking through the timelines and being able to witness firsthand these revelations that folks will have, or this newfound connection that they've got their hands on as far as their sense of home, their sense of place, their sense of not just how long we've been here, because Anishinaabe, we know, right, we've been here for countless generations, since time immemorial, right, this place has been our home. But getting to see that connection through a new angle is always exciting. We've also been able to see that this fire history work, it can connect to people from all sorts of different fields of study and fields of experience in different walks of life. Being able to share this type of information with the general public at conferences and speaking and hearing their questions that they have and how total strangers could feel connected now to these places that have been scarred by fire, by human impact on the landscape, has been beautiful to see. The wide variety of peoples that are now finding a deeper connection to a landscape through something as seemingly simple as scars on a red pine tree.
May Wright is a tribal historic preservation officer for the Little Traverse Bay Bands of Odawa Indians. She's also the NAGPRA representative for the tribe with responsibilities under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. May, it's been great talking to you. Miigwech, we really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's all for Stateside for today. Our show's producers are Ronia Kapansag, Michelle Jokishpolo, and April Van Buren. Our senior producer is Mercedes Mejia, and the executive producer of Stateside is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Public. We're a broadcast service of the University of Michigan. Thanks for listening today. I'm April Baer. We'll see you tomorrow. Take care till then.